Welcome to the Theology Mill, brought to you by Wittfenstock Publishers. I'm your host, Zach Mickel. On this podcast, we interview some of the leading authors in theology, biblical studies, philosophy, and more. Many of the folks we talk with on the show are also authors with us at Wittfenstock, where we have the honor of putting into print a broad swath of work that we hope nourishes both the academy and the church. On this episode, I interview Dr. William T. Kavanaugh. Dr. Kavanaugh is a prolific theologian, a professor at DePaul University in Chicago, and is known especially for his work in political theology. He is also a father of three sons and a husband. In this interview, Professor Kavanaugh and I talk about a whole host of subjects, including Kavanaugh's mentor Stanley Hauerwas, the recent overturning of Roe v. Wade, and the dangers of Donald Trump and the Republican Party. So with that, friends, let's jump over to the interview. Let's start by talking about Stanley Hauerwas. Obviously, you studied under him at Notre Dame and at Duke. I'd love to hear from you. I mean, I have read your Stan the Man, I think is what it's titled, chapter in the Hauerwas Reader, which is one of my favorite pieces of writing about Stanley, because it's such a personalized presentation of him. Mm-hmm. Even though, yeah, his personality really shines through in his writing, but that chapter especially is really fun. I'd love to hear from you. How would you describe kind of the influence of Stanley Hauerwas on you as a person and on your work?
Yeah, I owe Stanley so much. He kind of rocked my world when I first encountered him as an undergraduate in a Christian Ethics in America course. And he was basically, the question was, what difference does it make to be a Christian? And that kind of set me off on a path that I've kind of been following ever since in some ways. I just went to Paris with Stanley. We were invited, the two of us, to do a series of presentations, seminars, and public presentations and interviews and so on in Paris for a week at the Catholic University of Paris. And that was really fun to be with Stanley. I never imagined when I was an undergraduate that I would be privileged to share the same stage with Stanley, but that kind of brought our relationship. That was kind of the culmination of our relationship in a lot of ways. On a personal level, Stanley has always been just unfailingly generous to me and kind of formed me in ways of doing theology. He used to talk when I was a TA for him in graduate school. He used to start out his undergraduate classes by saying, some professors tell you they want you to think for yourselves, but I don't want that. I want you to think like me. He would say, you're 18-year-old Americans. You don't have minds worth making up. And the students, of course, would gasp and be scandalized by this. But then on kind of on a more advanced level, the first essay that I ever handed in one of his seminars in the grad level, he came back and he had scrawled on the front of it, "This sounds too much like me." You know, he doesn't want people to imitate him. He really wants people to kind of develop their own way of following Jesus, I guess. And so, so interesting kind of juxtaposition of those two kind of things. I mean, the first example when he talks about, I don't want you to think for yourselves, he's trying to make a point there that to kind of break down this autonomous idea that we all need to do is kind of craft our own theologies and ways of thinking. And it's more a matter of kind of following the master, who is ultimately God in Jesus. So on an intellectual and spiritual level, I take from Stanley his emphasis on ecclesiology, on the sacraments, on virtue ethics, as habituation, an appreciation of the Catholic tradition, which I'm a part of and he's not. And in some ways, all of those things are related to the incarnation, that Christianity has to be enfleshed in real life. That I think is maybe one of the central themes of Stanley's theology that I've tried to take on as well. And then there's other individual themes like nonviolence and so on, mm-hmm. That have been really influential for me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you and Stanley obviously both write quite a bit in political theology. So I'm curious with kind of the current state of kind of vitriol and partisanship in our country. What's your assessment of kind of where we're at as far as political partisanship, especially kind of as that relates to just sort of popular level discourse in America?
Yeah, I think something is going on that's more than just people are not nice to each other, or they're partisan and so on. It seems to me like you have to look for the roots of the current moment in the concentration of wealth and power that's been going on over the last few decades. It seems to me like starting in the 1970s, I suppose, corporations abandoned the ideas that they had responsibilities to anyone but shareholders. You know, this is Milton Friedman's idea that the only responsibility is to make money for the shareholders. And what had the kind of social compact that had been in place since, you know, kind of Fordism, where the idea is you treat your workers well enough that they can buy your products and you create a kind of middle class, a kind of very broad middle class. And that kind of staved off revolution from the 1930s onward. That kind of gets abandoned in the 1970s, 1980s, for this idea that people should make as much money as they can for themselves and their shareholders. And wealth and power become really concentrated from that point on. You know, the neoliberalism is basically the idea that the state should defend capitalism from democracy. So this kind of produces this extreme polarization in terms of wealth and power. And then that polarization, I think, just gets instituted in politics. And so someone like Trump, who comes along, is kind of an empty signifier. Populism has been described as the gathering of grievances around an empty signifier. And in a lot of ways, that's Trump. So people with grievances, people who feel abandoned, kind of project their grievances onto this figure who sees them, who notices them, and promises to rescue them. And so the Republican Party becomes the party of the underclasses, amazingly enough, by rallying them around bullshit like election conspiracy theories and guns and fear of Mexicans and this kind of cult of the strong man who will rescue you. And so you get blue collar workers in rural Alabama becoming convinced that some narcissistic billionaire from New York is their personal Lord and Savior. And so in a lot of ways, I think the current political moment is just the fruit, the rotten fruit of this realignment of wealth and power that's been coming for the last half century.
Thank you for that. I think we would be remiss again if we didn't bring up the recent Supreme Court decision. So I'm very interested to hear kind of how you've understood that decision and its relationship to the church's witness in America, but also if you think anything is lacking in kind of the current debates over abortion, maybe, you know, if there are things you would add or subtract from the conversation, what those might be.
I published an article before the election in 2020 arguing that it's been 50 years of Republican control, almost 50 years at the time of Republican control of the Supreme Court, and they've been promising to overturn Roe versus Wade, and they never have. It's like Lucy with the football, pulling it away from Charlie Brown at the last minute. And I was wrong about that. They did overturn Roe versus Wade. And I think for the church, I think it's a dangerous moment. Winning through the courts is always going to be a Pyrrhic victory, because you haven't kind of created the kind of consensus around these issues that that you're looking for. And so all you have to do is convince 5 of the 9 Supreme Court justices, and that I think is going to backfire against the church. And of course, what's even worse is winning on this issue through support of the Republican Party. And that, I think, is a disaster for the church, especially among young people. They see nothing but kind of lies and hypocrisy and corruption coming from Donald Trump's Republican Party. And the overturning of Roe versus Wade is not worth that. It's just going to send the issue back to the states, and you're going to end up with the same kind of polarization and lack of action for especially for, on behalf of women who would prefer not to resort to abortion, but would prefer to have children, but don't feel like they're capable of doing that. And that, I think, is part of what's missing from the current debates over abortion, is that I think it was Holly Taylor Coolman said, one side says, my body, my choice, which ironically is just like what the anti-vaxxers are saying. And the other body says, your baby, your problem. You know, you need to have your baby, but good luck with that, and we're not going to do anything to support you. So what's missing from the current debates, I think, is on the pro-life side, is what's missing is a real appreciation for what women go through, you know, how difficult and life-altering pregnancy and childbirth and raising a child can be, and in a very permanent way. And on the pro-choice side, there's just this refusal to even consider the moral status of an unborn child / baby / fetus, whatever the language might be. But it's all couched in terms of individual autonomy and the moral status of the intentional killing of a human life is not even considered. I think the current debate is really kind of bankrupt, and the church needs to do a better job of talking about both of those goods, the good of women's autonomy and the difficulty it's supporting them in the difficulty of these decisions, and the good on the other hand of being open to life in all its forms. I'm not sure what the answer to that is, but there's a lot of polarization on this where people are just talking past each other.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said about kind of the degeneration of the church's witness, especially among the younger population. Your book, The Field Hospital, you kind of followed Pope Francis's language there, describing the church as a field hospital. I guess, how would you say the church is doing as a field hospital? What does the church need to rediscover or repent of in order to fulfill that calling? And what other visions of the church have held sway today that you see leading to a failure of this vision of the church as a field hospital?
Yeah, I like that image that Pope Francis uses. I mean, field hospital indicates that it's kind of mobile, that the church is mobile and not just a kind of stationary institution. And the hospital part is a recognition that people are wounded. You're not just kind of making demands of people, but you're trying to meet people where they are in all of their various kinds of woundedness and who's not wounded. So the church, I think, needs to do better to get out of itself, go out into the streets, as Pope Francis says. Don't just cater to the intact middle-class church-going families, because the days are gone, I think, when you can just sit back and wait for people to come to the church. You have to go out to people, and we're really in, the United States and the global north in general are our mission territory now, and we need to realize that. We need to cross racial boundaries in a very deliberate way, I think, in particular. And the other visions that there are on offer out there include just kind of resentment and nostalgia. We want to return to power for the church, at least using the courts and the state to protect the church. Donald Trump, when he was running the first time, said to an audience of Christians in Iowa, "If I'm president, you'll have plenty of power. You won't need anybody else." And that kind of temptation, I think, is disastrous. And if anything, is just accelerating secularization, because people see the church as complicit with this kind of mendacity that Trump represents, and they don't want any part of it. And so this emphasis on defending religious freedom, I think in some ways that's important for the church to be free to be the church and not have too much state interference. But the impulse oftentimes behind religious freedom is just the defense of the institution with power. And I think that if you keep going down that road, there won't be anybody left in the church whose freedom needs defending.
Yeah, speaking to, again, to kind of the bankruptcy of the church's witness to younger folks, what can or do you say to students of your own who kind of look at the state of the church and feel like, there's nothing there for them, nothing desirable, and especially that the church is not the kind of community that you call it to be in your work. What kind of hope can you give to those who are not necessarily interested in the church?
Yeah, I get it. For every reason you can give me for leaving the church, I can give you two more. I've been around the church, all my life and around the world, and I see what the problems are. I stay in the church because I like it, and because I think it is in some non-trivial sense true, right? And I think It's not very often that we talk about being in church because we like it, that it's an attractive place, but it still is for me. And that, in a sense, is a kind of sociological argument. And there are all sorts of sociological arguments. You can tell people all the great things there are to enjoy the church in terms of community and action for social justice and ritual and a sense of higher purpose and meaning and so on. And I think it's probably true that the loss of church affiliation on the whole is not going to be good for us, either individually or as a society. But you can't just stay on the sociological level. I think you need to go to the theological level and need to go to the root of it. How is the church not just like a moose lodge or some other sort of communal gathering? So I go to church because I think the gospel of Jesus Christ is true and important and necessary. And I'm not just talking about giving me a higher sense of meaning. I'm talking about the root idea of Christianity, that God humiliated God's self to take the form of a poor man who was tortured to death and then did not take revenge on the torturers. And that makes all the difference. And the church is where we remember that and participate in Christ's body. But of course, you can't just say this, right? And this has to be lived. And so groups of Christians just need to live it and invite people to live it with us. And if we live it, I think people will be attracted to it, because it's inherently attractive.
Yeah, you've related the Eucharist and kind of social and political realities in really interesting ways in your work. Just tell me a little bit more about what role the Eucharist has played in your own theology.
Yeah, so my first book was Torture and Eucharist, where I talk about the church's response to human rights abuses under the military regime in Chile. I lived in Chile for a couple of years in a poor neighborhood in Santiago in the last years of the military dictatorship there. And Torture and Eucharist are kind of the two movements of the book. Torture, the kind of splintering atomization of the body politic, and Eucharist, the kind of gathering of the body back together. Torture has a way of making people fearful and staying away from any kind of organized action, and Eucharist kind of bringing that back together. And so talk about different kind of Eucharistic practices that made that possible. Unfortunately, today in Chile, the story is very different, and the church is kind of in a shambles. There have been all sorts of sexual abuse scandals, and the bishops there have been more interested in, you know, defending the institution than living this vision of the Eucharist out. And so, so I talk about the Eucharist as being important, but there's nothing automatic about it. And I think I've been criticized for, you know, talking about the Eucharist as if it's some kind of magical panacea. And of course it's not. As Paul says in 1 Corinthians 11, the body of Christ can kill us, right? It's if we eat and drink the body without discerning the body and the community, then, you know, Paul thinks that this is the reason why some people are dying, right? So the Eucharist is a judgment against us as much as anything else.
Speaking of the Eucharist, I know, I think Ephraim Radner at one point in his work kind of critiques, I think it's your book, The Myth of Religious Violence, essentially saying like that you might be kind of externalizing the blame for violence from the church onto kind of social and political movements. And I think he also critiques John Paul II there, basically saying, that JP2 was kind of putting the blame for violence. I think he's talking about in the context of Rwanda, he kind of was putting the blame on individual Christians, but not the church as such. Mm-hmm. How might your insights on the Eucharist and resistance apply in a context where the violence of the culture seems to kind of enter into the church itself, especially, in our context where we might see kind of a militant or far right turn within the church?
Yeah, I've responded to Ephraim Radner. We had a session together at the AAR after his book came out, and I've published that in my book Field Hospital too. So if you're interested in that argument, you can see it in more detail there. I think he's fundamentally misread what I was trying to say. He thinks I'm trying to say it's not religion; it's really politics. But of course, the whole point that I'm trying to make in The Myth of Religious Violence is that you can't make these kinds of separations between religion and politics. And so the point is not that the church is innocent and everybody else is to blame. The point is rather that the church has become complicit in violence precisely by aligning itself with the powers that be, especially the nation state. And so Radner thinks that the antidote to religious violence is the liberal nation state. And I warn that that's more problem than solution, that the church has precisely kind of abandoned its own commitments to the cessation of violence, and instead has learned that killing for Jesus is bad, but killing for the nation state is okie dokie. That it's in very bad taste to even proselytize on behalf of Jesus, but we think nothing of slaughtering other people on behalf of the flag and so on. So Radner kind of agreed with me that was a misreading of the argument. What is the insights of Eucharist and resistance where the violence has been taken into the church? I mean, that's where we need to do penance, right? We need to do penance for the ways that people actually do kill. It may have been true that Christians at one time did in fact kill for doctrinal matters, although I think it's considerably more complicated than that. But what we kill for now, here and now, is not that. Christians kill for the state, and we need to do penance for that and try to extricate ourselves from that kind of war making.
Yeah, so in Torture and Eucharist, I mean, from the beginning in your work, you're kind of looking to global social and political realities in your theology. So I'm curious kind of why that global turn in your work, why you've decided to feature these social and ecclesial realities, along with some, you know, non-Western theologies. That's kind of a central feature in a lot of your work, and maybe what you've learned throughout your career in terms of kind of the global aspects of your work.
Yeah, so I mean, as you said, my first book is on the church in Chile. And so I don't think there's really been a kind of global turn more recently in my work. I think that concern has been there since the beginning. I went to Chile looking for the church that Hauerwas was talking about, and in some ways found it. And so what I found in the church in Latin America, especially in those years, was kind of incarnating the gospel from the starting point of the marginalized. And that's been an important theme in my work, I think, all along. In 2013, I became the director of the Center for World Catholicism and Intercultural Theology at DePaul. And so that's when the concentration of that's when I became an administrator of this center. I came to DePaul as a fellow of the center, and so my work was considered to be work that was within this ambit of the Church in the Global South. But then when I became director of the center, it has made me kind of think more broadly and has made me create more ties with Christians, especially Catholics, around the globe. So Africa and Asia, as well as Latin America. And I think that helps me be more Catholic. I mean, some of the lessons, I suppose, that can be learned from that, and that I've learned, is there's a sense of the presence of God in marginalized places. The figure of Jesus Christ is so important in a lot of places precisely because of Jesus' status as a marginalized person in many ways. And that's the kind of attractiveness of Christ in many places in the Global South, is precisely because God is with those who are on the margins of the world system. Another thing I think that's important about the witness of the churches in the Global South now is that you get a keen sense that Christianity is not something for Sundays, but it's for Mondays through Fridays as well. It has to do with every aspect of people's lives in a lot of places in the Global South. But the church is not, therefore, a kind of NGO whose only business is to provide healthcare and job training and, you know, training and farming techniques and so on. As important as those are, there's also this kind of active presence of God, the active presence of the Holy Spirit in those churches. And I think that's something that that we can take inspiration from. And in a lot of ways, political theology is a dangerous field because it always faces the temptation to reduce theology to politics, right? And that can be part of the internal secularization of Christianity in the West, where we think that the only way we can survive is to be relevant and to talk about social justice issues and so on. And obviously, I think those issues are hugely important, but the way that we do them, the way that we talk about them, needs to be theological and have a sense of that active presence of God in the world. Because if God doesn't solve the problems, they're not going to get solved. And that's, I think, something that you can see in the churches in the Global South.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that reminds me of Stanley Hauerwas's distinction between kind of phrasing it as political theology versus theological politics. I like that. As far as ecumenism, because you've written on ecumenism, what would you say are maybe some of the key differences between ecumenism in its Western form and ecumenism on kind of the Global South stage?
Yeah, I edited that volume on ecumenism for the series that we have with Cascade. And I think it's a good volume. It came out of a conference that we did where we brought people from all over the world to deal with these issues. And that was a conference in 2017 on the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, because so much of what was going on to commemorate the Reformation had to do with Europe and the US. And so I think it was an interesting project to kind of see what the state of ecumenism beyond the West is. One of the differences between the West and elsewhere is that in the West, you kind of find that the competition amongst denominations has waned somewhat as the church shrinks. We now realize that as Christians, we have a lot more in common in a secularized society, that we kind of need each other more in the face of a increasingly secularized societies. And so the doctrinal differences tend to fade, and people make different kinds of alliances. In the U.S., oftentimes you'll find evangelicals and Catholics working together on certain issues, whereas a few decades before, you'd find some evangelicals would have considered Catholics to be unsaved and vice versa. And the church is not shrinking in places like Africa and Asia. And so the dynamics there are different. Oftentimes you still do have this kind of competition for converts amongst different denominations and so on. But there's also cooperation. You get what Pope Francis calls an ecumenism of blood. And so in Pinochet's Chile, you get the Catholics and the Lutherans cooperating in resistance to the military regime. We have an interesting essay in that volume on Hong Kong and the collaboration between Catholics and Protestants there. And the phenomenon of in the case of Latin America is different, where you had this kind of hegemony of Catholicism that's been eroded by Protestant evangelization over the last century. But in a lot of ways, it's more subtle and nuanced there as well, because the competition from Protestants has in many ways made the Catholic Church stronger in a lot of areas. Todd Harch talks about this in his book about the rebirth of Latin American Christianity, that there's a lot of places in which people were nominally Catholic, but it's only because of the efforts of Protestants to convert people that Catholic laity have also gotten energized in response.
Yeah, speaking of kind of ecumenical cooperation, I guess, what would you say, because I know Eastern Orthodox and Catholics and many evangelicals have really started to cooperate on ecological issues. So I'm very curious to hear how you would kind of frame the church's role in caring for the created world.
Yeah, I think that's a really hopeful thing. The ecumenical patriarch of the Orthodox Church, Patriarch Bartholomew, has been really a leader on these issues of caring for creation. And Pope Francis has has as well, with Laudato Si. I think it's important when the church looks at these issues that the church have something interesting to say that's not just the same thing that everybody else is saying. And I think a lot of what the church can contribute is seeing the ecological crisis at root as a theological crisis. It's a crisis about the way we think about God and God's relation to us and to the world. The abuse of creation starts when we recognize nothing higher than ourselves. And in a lot of ways, that what Pope Francis calls the technocratic paradigm won't solve it. It won't solve it alone. We can't just kind of rely on technology to get us out of the problem. We need a new kind of humility, really, a humility before God and before our fellow creatures, and a recognition that we're all interdependent and that we're all dependent, right, ultimately on God and on the creation that God has made. And this kind of runs contrary to this attitude that, well, we can, we have been really good at gaining power over creation. And now, in order to save creation, we just have to find new and better ways of exercising our power over creation. And I think that's just going to exacerbate the problem. So what we need is a kind of turning back and a humility that allows us to relinquish certain kinds of power or certain kinds of attempts at power and recognize our own interdependence. And that, of course, has not just ecological but social ramifications as well. You know, Pope Francis talks about, and several of the popes have talked about, a kind of social mortgage on property, the idea that property is not just ours to do whatever we want with it, but that the earth belongs ultimately to God, and we need to recognize that it belongs to all of us together communally and make decisions on what we do with our property on the basis of what's going to be good for everybody, the common good.
Yeah, your answer makes me think of John Vizulas. He talks a lot about kind of the Christian approach to creation being done Eucharistically, of, you know, our role as humans in caring for creation is to offer the created world, right, in the Mass, offer the created world upward to the Lord. But yeah, speaking of Pope Francis, what would you say have been kind of the biggest effects of his pontificate? And I guess, how would you compare it also to his predecessors, especially Benedict XVI and Pope John Paul II?
Yeah, I think it's possible to exaggerate the difference in theology between Benedict XVI and John Paul II on the one hand and Francis on the other hand. But there certainly is a different style that I think can be characterized as kind of clarity versus charity. For Benedict XVI and John Paul II, I think there was this idea that we're living in a dictatorship of relativism, where truth is just whatever you happen to think it is. And so the church's most urgent task is to be clear on what it stands for and you know, what's doctrinally true and what's not. Whereas the approach of Pope Francis, I think, emphasizes charity over clarity, that in order to get people to even consider what the church has to say on any particular issue. You've got to meet them where they are and accompany them pastorally. So it's not a doctrinal approach. It's a kind of pastoral approach. You have to give people a reason to care what the church might be saying on one particular issue. There's a lot of Catholics that are concerned that Pope Francis has muddied the waters and confused people. And I just don't think that's really the case. I think people know exactly where the church stands on, you know, some of these sexual issues and so on. But what he's done is kind of open up a space for dialogue, and, you know, where gay people can be heard and seen, for example, and not just vilified. And I think that's been a really positive thing. He's also reforming the institution by attacking clericalism, which I think is kind of the root of many evils in the Catholic Church, this kind of clerical caste that is suspicious of lay people, especially women. And he has, for example, now allowed women to be head of dicasteries in the Vatican and has invited more women into positions of leadership. And that, I think, is it's a promising start. There's a lot more that needs to be done. But the whole tone that he has set is to be a church of service and not to come not to be served, but to serve. For too long, there's, you know, a lot of bishops came to be served and not to serve. And so there's a different type of person that gets promoted in the Catholic Church these days because of Francis. The people that he has named as cardinals who will vote for his successor tend to be not the kind of traditional princes of the church, but people that serve in marginalized areas. And I think that's a really hopeful thing.
Yeah, I've heard you make that distinction before between charity and clarity. I think that's really helpful, and the necessity for both and how different popes have emphasized each. Pope Francis holding charity first while also maintaining clarity. I like that. Okay, last question and then we can wrap up. Has your mind changed in significant ways throughout your career? And if so, how?
Yeah, I had to write a piece for that Christian Century series called How My Mind Has Changed. And that was just I can't remember when that came out, maybe a year ago or something. And I talk about how one of the things that attracted me to Hauerwas's theology in the first place was finding a distinct identity for as a Catholic in an atmosphere growing up in the suburbs where kind of all identities had just sort of melted into, you know, kind of standard American kind of, you know, melting pot blandness. And so kind of finding as an identity, a kind of undigestible identity as a Catholic, I think was really important to me at one stage in my life, but I think I finally realized that I've had too much church and not enough God. And the church is, you know, it's shrinking largely for by its own fault in the U.S. It's growing elsewhere, but elsewhere it's going to get you know, there's going to be scandals and so on there. So although I still think ecclesiology is a really important part of theology and what we do, but I think one of the ways my mind has changed is just to see that that we need to give up any kind of temporal hopes for the church and just leave it in God's hands. That God is still God, even if the church is falling apart.
Love that. Okay, yeah, let's wrap up there. I just want to say thanks again for taking the time out of your day for this.
Thanks for listening to the Theology Mill, brought to you by Whitfinstock Publishers. If you liked what you heard and would like to hear more, you can subscribe to our show, where we have a lot more content coming your way. I'm your host, Zach Mickle, signing off on this episode of the Theology Mill. We hope to see you again to share a drink and talk all things theology. Until then, God bless, and we'll see you soon. Thank you.